Welcome to Let's Talk Cancer. My name is Carey Adams, and I'm the CEO of the Union for International Cancer Control. In 2019, just before his 31st birthday, Ian Ward was diagnosed with stage 3 brain cancer. He was given about 5 years to live. Undeterred by the prognosis, Ian decided to dedicate his remaining years to achieving something worthwhile. He set his sights on breaking the world record for the most money raised for running a marathon, and aside from fundraising for a worthy cause, it is also his way of showing that those with mental health or medical conditions are not defined by their condition. Ian, thank you very much for agreeing to talk to me today. It's a real pleasure to meet you.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on.
Tell us about when you were first diagnosed. When was that and how did that happen?
So I was first diagnosed with brain cancer a little around 4 years ago now, coming up to 4 years. Prior to that, they had had a scan on me, pretty much a random scan. And in a very lucky and unlucky way, they were able to see the tumor.
And why did you have a scan?
Oh, because I love money, but I hate working at stuff that I don't enjoy. So I would do medical trials quite a lot. And then my form of sort of regular income would be teaching fitness classes.
And so you went on a trial?
Yep, I've done several medical trials before. And one of these particular trials that went on, they always have to make sure that, for my category anyway, sometimes they deliberately do medical trials on people who are sick to see if certain medications work. But for me, it was always like, we need healthy young guys or healthy young people, whatever the category particularly was. And so they went in there and like, okay, cool. We've just got to make sure certainly that you are healthy and that you're fit to be the sort of the control. If you understand the processes of scientific research, you need to be a control element in this. And so they went and they tested and they scanned my head. And then they said, you have a brain tumor in here. It looks like it's benign, but you have to get this checked out. You have to get this known. And then, of course, they asked afterwards, like, have you had any headaches? Have you been, like, you know, dizziness, any poor ways of articulating your words, anything? And it was just, no. And, like, nothing at all. And I was saying, absolutely no symptoms whatsoever. And then so when I went in for my second scan and I spoke to the brain surgeon about it, he was saying, like, you know, now, Ian, we've just done a second scan and it does look cancerous and that is bad news, but I can't stress that. I know this is not the right time to tell you this, but you have no idea how lucky you are to have caught this without symptoms, because brain cancer, a lot of young people, the survival rate is quite low with it. And so the fact that I was able to catch it, not before it had developed from like stage 1 to stage 2 to stage 3, because it was stage 3 when they were able to see it, but before it started affecting my ability to do anything. And so, yeah, I'm the luckiest unlucky man in the world.
Yeah, oh, that's a good way of describing it. So I understand that you underwent brain surgery whilst you were awake.
So the reason that they do that is your brain is, I always like to use the metaphor that your brain is much like a room in a house with different things within the room. And so quite a lot of your brain is actually space, but your brain can actually move that into different rooms in the house. So you can actually convert, you know, your sitting room into a sitting room with a kitchen. And so what they do is they go in and they just try to remove the space as much as possible without damaging the stuff that's practical, like the bed, the chair, the couch, the sofa, things that humans use. And so the way they do that is they prod around and they have just like, as far as I know, it's just sort of like a pencil. And so they poke. And then because it was on the left side of my brain, because I'm right-handed, which is really interesting. I think that it makes such an effect on how your brain works. My left temporal lobe, because I'm right-handed, is the area of speech. So when they were poking around, they were simply asking basic questions, like we were playing an incredibly boring version of Articulate, where they would have a photo of a cat and a dog on thing, and they would say, what's this? And it would simply look for me slowing down, like I just did there, where I would be like, a cat. And they would look for areas where I would be pausing and not getting quickly to just say, that's a dog, that's a cat, that's a bear, that's a pole, that's a whatever. From that, they were able to be like, okay, this is functional tissue. We won't remove that. Let's move around somewhere else. This is not functional tissue. We can remove this. And so they removed the space, not the utensils, not the appliances. Then what happens afterwards is actually more interesting. As your body, as your brain heals, it has something called plasticity. The younger you are, the more of an effect this can have. So that was one of the things that they were saying when they're talking about you have 5 years to live, but that's an average. We don't have 30-year-olds in. The younger you are, the more your brain is able to repair. And so what my brain might have done, we don't know. We won't know until like there's a second surgery, if that happens at all. My brain might have moved all of the pieces in my left temporal lobe that are associated with speaking and articulating into a completely different section. So if the tumor is in the same location as it was beforehand and we're going in for a second surgery, they might remove a larger portion of the tumor and absolutely nothing associated with it might have something to do with my speech. My brain might have moved it completely into a different lobe. And so the second surgery might even be more effective than the first one. So there you go.
That's fascinating.
It's very interesting, isn't it?
And tell me what was it like?
Have you ever seen Casino?
Is that a film?
It is, yes.
No, I don't think I have.
It's a Scorsese film, and there's a scene in it where one of the main characters in it, one of the nasty guys in it, is trying to get information out of someone, and they put his head in a vice grips, and they're squeezing his head. And that's kind of what it feels like, because it's that even though they open up your head under a numbing agent, under an anesthetic, they still, like the pressure of what's going on, you still sort of feel that. Your brain doesn't have a nervous system, and then the actual sort of incision and even the drilling of your skull open, it's not actually that painful in terms of like if someone was pinching your arm, you'd feel it right there, but you feel this, the pressure and almost the inflammation that comes out afterwards, just in your whole head. So it's difficult in that regard. But to be honest, the painful part of the whole situation is that you have to remain perfectly still. I was in the fetal position, so like up on that, and it was after about like 3 hours, maybe 4 hours. I think it was 4 hours in total. My hips were just cramping up really bad. Even though that's a natural way to sleep, you still are shimmying around while you sleep, or you can't do that while you're under the knife. And that was what sort of, they were like, right, he's going to start to twitch soon enough. These are serious cramps. This is, we have to end the surgery now.
And from that experience, you were inspired to do something difficult and meaningful. So tell us what happened.
It was simply that I had a very small social media account based on just playing video games, and that was because over COVID we just had all this free time, and we had this idea of starting something like this up anyway. And then so I already had the concept of, right, well, if I'm going to continue doing this thing, I need to address the elephant in the room, because people are going to be able to see the side of my head. People are going to be able to see the scar for the first couple of months. We don't know how much radiotherapy is going to affect my hair. So like there might be no ability to cover it up. So we have to mention this. So the idea where it was like, I'll do something for charity. That was already sort of in my mind. And then once they gave me the prognosis after the surgery, where they're able to do tests on the tissues themselves, that was the point where I was like, right, this is serious. There's like, I didn't slip out. I didn't get away with it. And then from that point, it was like, how about I use this against itself, where I know I'm able to like walk around and I'm able to physically do things. I might get tired from the chemotherapy that I've got coming up, but I'm still going to be able to do certain things. And so it was like, I knew it kind of made a unique story. A good story requires something to overcome and to get past. And it was like, right, you have that, but you kind of have a cheating version of it because you've brain cancer, and brain cancer doesn't affect the body or the nervous system until it does. You're fine until it does. And then once it starts to really hit you, it hits you hard. and then you often die quite soon afterwards. So in my mind, I was like, right, you have a window where you have this title, but you don't have the negative things associated with this title of being having someone with cancer. So you can take advantage of that. And that's me. I just saw that as an opportunity. It was like, you got to do this and you got to do it right now.
And you decided to go for a world record, is that right?
Yeah, I was just tinkering around with the on the internet of like, how much is the most money someone's ever raised for this? I had done a marathon before. I knew the association with running a marathon and how it's like basically like a cake sale. It's a gigantic charity event. And so that was the first thing that I went to. And I was like, okay, the world record for most money raised for running a marathon is 2.3 million Great British pounds. So that is a lot of money, but it is not an amount of money that I think is sort of out of my reach from someone who's starting from nothing. And then same sort of thing where I was like, okay, let's see. The marathon's great for normal people to have a world record with, because you can just dress up as something silly and you can be as specific as you want. You could be like, I want to be the fastest person to run a marathon dressed as a remote control. It really doesn't matter. The Guinness World Records do not say, no, that's silly, we're not doing that. And so I looked up, like, let's do video games, seeing as how I've started a social media channel based around video games. So I looked up fastest person dressed as a video game character, and it's just under the sub 3 hour mark, which is very hard to do, but much like the millions earned, it's something that if one was to focus, that it could be achieved. And so, yeah, the first two marathon or two world records that I looked up, they were the first two that I chose to make my life goal about.
Forget my ignorance. Where is the marathon?
Which one? I'm doing 12 this year.
Oh, my word. Where are you doing them?
All right. So in chronological order, I'm doing Boston in 5 days, London in 9 days. Then we have a big summer break. There might be some more that pop up in the meantime in there. And then in a 35-day window, so 5-week window, we have Berlin, Chicago, Antarctica, South Africa, Perth, Istanbul again, Colombia, Miami, and then the last one we do is New York.
I'm just tired listening to that.
Yeah, it's two marathons a week in around October.
And how is the fundraising going?
Because this is such a unique thing to want to do, I knew that I had to do it in a unique way. And particularly with how much COVID was affecting people's finances, I knew that if I was asking for donations, that it would have a start, but then it would hit a plateau, it would hit a wall, and then I wouldn't be able to push past it, and then the momentum would stop, and then I think it would fizzle away. And so what I thought of was, if I just ask people to follow the account, and then with the accounts getting large, with the social media accounts getting large, I can then ask businesses to sponsor me, but I get the sponsorship money to go directly to the cancer research charity as opposed to going to me. And so I thought, it doesn't matter what happens in the world in terms of finances, whether there's like, you know, everybody is absolutely like the poorest we've been in a century, people will still be able to follow an account on social media.
I understand you've got over 5 million people.
Yeah, 4.8 on TikTok and then 2.5 on Instagram.
And how important is that following to you in terms of what you're doing?
It's vital. It's absolutely vital. If there's no followers, then it's like, how am I going to be able to pitch to a company like MyProtein and say, hey, can you like give us a load of money and I'll advertise? And it's like, well, what you're doing is, you know, admirable, but who advertised to who? You know, you haven't got a platform, you haven't got an audience. Why would we involve you? And so that's why having the large social media channel is so important. And so the fundraising has been going really well. The American Cancer Society have now sort of put a page exclusively on their website just for what my achievement is, which makes things so much easier because it just stamps out any doubt any kind of an organization would ever have to be like, you know, what's where's the money going? Oh, it's going on a world record. Like, ah, I don't know. This guy swears a lot and he's sort of a bit manic. Let's not do that. But when it's such a strong association with a household name like the American Cancer Society, it means like, okay, this guy's reliable.
What's been the reaction from people online to your story or your filmmaking? As you know, has it been a overwhelmingly positive? Have you had supportive? What's been the overall reaction?
I'm a social media unicorn. No one else has a channel that is, or has channels that are as big as mine. And really, I don't get that much negative feedback. I was expecting people would be like, this is a scam, like this is fake, and it doesn't happen.
And you raise money not just for cancer, but also for mental health. Can you explain why you did that?
Years and years ago now, I think it's just gone 11 years. One of my close friends, he ended his own life. He committed suicide. And so it's always been more of a personal thing for me. It's the same when I was raising money for Movember. Movember, a big part of being both cancer research and mental health is a big focus of theirs at the moment.
With regard to, you know, the cancer and mental health, though, there's lots of studies and evidence that cancer treatment in itself and survival of cancer can cause significant mental health problems. Are you aware of those? And has anything like that occurred to you?
I mean, it's almost impossible to avoid the awareness of those sort of things. I myself have not lost anything within my own sort of body. My ability to exercise hasn't been affected. I don't have regular headaches. I've lost a bit of hair, but like I've got big thick Irish hair, so I have a sort of a, I don't even need a comb over. It's not up here, it's on the side, so my hair naturally covers it up. And I, you know, you can look at old photographs of me on Facebook, I rock a long haircut most of the time anyway, so that's the only sort of major issue with me personally. But the association that other people have, where it can take away so many different things of your life, and it's you're not going to be able to get them back, I'd imagine it hits people very hard. And in a lot of ways, I'm asked quite a lot about how I'm able to deal with my situation in such a positive way. And this one is luck, because I don't think it's anything that I've earned, but I just have a disposition where it doesn't bother me so much of what I've gone through. And I wish I was able to give the advice of what I sort of go through every day to overcome that, but I just don't know what it is. I suppose the ongoing issue that I have would probably be with relationships, because I'm at the age now where I don't want like a one night stand. I don't want to, you know, date a girl for a couple of weeks. Like, I want to have a partner who's, you know, my other half for as long as, you know, we can tolerate one another. And then, but from a sales point of view, if it's just purely, you know, business, if you could think of marriage just purely as a business for this particular situation, if I say that I have a possibly very short shelf life, any smart woman would say like, okay, well, worst case scenario, I fall in love with you, we're going great, but then, you know, you die early and then, you know, you're not around, and then I'm sad for the rest of my life because I've had you and I've lost you. Whereas if I had, say, and I'm not using this as a comparison to be like lung cancer has it easy, but if I say I had lung cancer and then I went through all my treatments and I had to lose a lung, but then I was in remission, because they can't really determine remission from brain cancer because they can't remove all the brain tissue. It's just too difficult to do that. Whereas they can do that with lung cancer. They can get rid of it all. And then you can kind of say like, I've been in remission, so I know I've dealt with cancer. It's in a past tense. And then you could sort of, I think you could get into a relationship and someone could be like, yeah, they dealt with something. They can't run anymore. They can't do marathons. But like, you know, he's still going to be alive when he's 70, unless, you know, something else pops up. So I suppose that's my thing that I have to deal with in my mind.
Let's move on to some of the vocabulary that's used with regard to cancer. A lot of it is good old fighting talk, fight cancer, survivors and things like that. lot of battle metaphors, as they call it. Is this something that you relate to or not?
Me personally, no. But it goes to that same sort of hopeful ethos of we need to get together, we need to group together, and we need to fight this thing. Because I think people prefer the idea of fighting something because it's something that can be physically done. It requires you to show up somewhere to have trained for this and be ready. Whereas the reality of it is, to fight cancer is incredibly difficult to do because it's more of a passive thing. It's more of a metaphorical thing, which people and I'm not saying like I'm not included in this myself, but it's a far more difficult concept to battle against. I would imagine a lot of people can't even, like, it wouldn't be something that you would say about mental health as a comparison. You wouldn't hear people saying like, we got to fight mental health, because it doesn't quite suit, because mental health it's even more of a passive thing, whereas cancer in a way you can see it as a physical thing, because there are physical ways to deal with. There's chemotherapy, which is a physical thing. There's more exercise. There's, you know, there's a slight more of a physical association. So that's why I focused on the come to war with me, join me, and whatnot.
Well, as a king, I suppose you're allowed to do those things.
Yeah,
you're allowed to call your people to go to war for you. How do you feel at the moment? Nearly 4 years on.
So it was 4 years ago. Well, coming up to 4 years ago that I was given the statistics of, you are in this situation. You have these different sort of attributes. We have, according to research, it says that the average life expectancy is about 5 years. But something that they focused on, where it was like, now these are stats. This is an average. It's based off of a bell curve. Some people who have brain cancer live until, you know, 30 years. Some people die within a month. It is like, it's an average. So the average years for someone in my situation was 5 years. But then the doctors also added, where it's like, but you are 30 and we do not have data on 30-year-olds with no symptoms. It just doesn't happen. People who have no symptoms to go in to get a scan are usually in their 60s, because that's something that people do after retirement. It's like, I'm now retired, I'm going to go do a big medical check, see if there's anything going wrong with my body. And that's where the non-symptom scan occurs. Whereas 30-year-olds, you know, we don't go like, you know, I'm not feeling sick in any way, I'm going to go get like, you know, a full medical examination. I think it was 2 years ago we got a good result saying that there's a slight shrinkage in the brain tumor. And since that slight shrinkage, every 3 months with the scan, it said that there has been no growth. So we're in a good place, as much as one can hope for in a shit place.
And do you find that your story is inspiring other people? And they're not just following you because they're interested, but it's inspiring others with cancer?
I think the most powerful ones that I've come across is where someone has said something that is tangible, isn't quite the right word, but I can imagine it being a truth, because I do the same thing sometimes. And they were saying that they were in their bed and they were flicking through their phone, you know, just as people do. And then they came across one of my videos and it inspired them to get out of the bed. And that's a small thing, but it's also a big thing. And I know, because I've been in that sort of situation myself, where not even necessarily that I've been massively depressed, but I've just been wasting my time flicking through on Instagram or TikTok or whatever. And then a video comes along where it's, you know, encourages you to get out of the bed and actually start living life. For someone to simply say, I got out of bed because I watched your video, that means a lot.
Ian, it's been a real pleasure talking to you, and I really appreciate your, you know, incredible character.
Thank you very much. Make sure you get out of bed tomorrow.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Let's Talk Cancer. If you want to hear other inspirational stories by people with an experience of cancer, why not listen to episode 29 on caregiving for a loved one with terminal cancer, episode 23 on racial disparities in breast cancer, or episode 14 on overcoming 8 cancer diagnoses. And as always, do reach out at communications@uicc.org or on social media with any questions and suggestions.